You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves. In this edition of Women Making Waves, we speak to visionary composer Shirley J. Thompson, OBE. Performed and screened worldwide, Shirley's music is often described as beautiful and powerful, and is recognised for her unique approach to making music to affect social, cultural and political change.
We also meet Professor Catherine Barnard. You may have heard Catherine on the radio and TV talking about Brexit. She is Professor of European and Employment Law at Trinity College, Cambridge, and a leading researcher working on the issues surrounding the Brexit negotiations.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Composer Shirley Thompson, OBE, is recognised for her unique approach to making music. Shirley pushes the boundaries of classical music arrangements and has recently been recognised for bringing more audiences to the genre with an OBE in 2019 for services to music. Susie Thorpe talks to Shirley.
I mean, there was always music in the house, so there was always gospel music in the house, there was always reggae music in the house.
Oh, lovely.
There was always blue beat music, ska. So I grew up in a house full of Jamaican music. My parents are Jamaican, part of my culture is Jamaican. There was always a lot of music in the house, always a lot of dancing. I mean, I remember being taken to parties every week and weddings and christenings.
Delighted to have with me today Dr. Shirley Thompson, OBE. And I say OBE, there are many other letters to the right of your name as well. But if I start off with composer, conductor, artistic director and educator and violinist, I would say there's probably a lot more to that, would you say, than what I've just got there?
that's quite a lot for today. Thanks, Susie.
And then underneath on your website, this is what I find really interesting, is that it says Radio 3, BBC Radio 3 have quoted, a pioneering and wonderfully dramatic composer, a leading voice in the world of contemporary classical music. That was Classic FM. Now, in those words, do you feel you are a pioneer or a leading voice?
Thanks, Susie. Well, I know that I have had to carve my own way for my voice to be heard in classical music, because I came through a time in classical music when a particular style of music was very popular and esteemed. I suppose analogous to this is perhaps looking at contemporary art, where abstract art leads, maybe figurative, aren't seen as boundary pushing. And in classical music, in contemporary classical music, the world that I inhabit, it's very much about boundary pushing all the way. And if you're writing something that's vaguely tuneful, and my music is vaguely tuneful, then it's not seen to be boundary pushing by some persons. So, but I think I've championed that way of introducing more lyrical, tuneful, but challenging, encapsulating and sensational music by using tunes and more lyrical material.
It's really refreshing to hear you say that, because I am no classical expert. I love my music and I've grown to love classical more as I get older. But I feel that when I was younger, it would have been nicer to have learnt a bit more. So let's talk about when you were younger, because you grew up, as I said, in the family of five, is that right? From East London. And you started off at school. Where did you find that this was the moment for you? You needed to be in music, or did that come a little bit later?
Well, it's still coming, Susie. But I was always good at lots of things. I loved history, and I was actually, in going to university, I was torn between taking music and history, actually.
Right.
And music sort of swung it for the balance, because I'd spent so much time on activities surrounding music, such as being in musical productions and being in the choir, being in the orchestras, whereas history was very much a book-led sort of activity and all in the head, really, all in mind. Whereas music was a lot of sort of it's very performative, as well as being very scientific and artistic. So I ended up studying music, which I'm very happy about, because I went to Liverpool University specifically for the reason that I could take both modern history, which I took, and music. So, and my interests have still been very diverse since that time.
So you've been to university. Did you find then at a certain stage when you were at school that the story I want to bring in is, because when my daughter was on holiday with us, we had a fantastic holiday away with another family, but I could hear a conversation, and my daughter told me about this conversation later on, but I actually heard the conversation where she was about 13, or no, she was about 15, and her friend was also 15, he was a boy, and they were talking about music and women in music and women playing instruments.
Really?
And in orchestras.
Goodness.
And she said, at 15, she said, we need to have more women playing in the in orchestras.
Incredible.
But the chap said, women aren't good in orchestras. Men are better. Men are much better. I was so shocked at that at 15, and we're talking nearly 12 years ago now that happened. Do you found that when you were growing up that you had these sort of perceptions of women in orchestra and music? You're taken aback by that, aren't you?
I know, I'm absolutely shocked. And, I mean, we are having this talk on a day when, in the news...
He was an advisor, wasn't
An advisor
he? Yes.
has resigned because he had similar thoughts, very unpleasant thoughts about gender.
Well, he's probably the same age as the chap that was
That's
probably...
Right.
So this is what worries me, that we still have this sort of...
Yes.
Bias. Maybe you didn't find this, but did you sort of see it, ignore it, and move forward? Were your parents very encouraging?
Yes. I mean, my parents, I think, I mean, especially my mother, instilled me with so much self-belief. That's because my mother has always said, you know, you've got the same brain as anybody else. You know, you just need to use it. So I've just never felt different in my abilities to do what I need to do or want to do, because from my very early days, my mother has always said to all of us that we can be whatever we want to be. I mean, I'm aware of all the dynamics going on around me, and I'm aware of all the, probably opportunities that I've not been offered, had.
Do you think that did? Do you actually feel that is something that you haven't been offered because you are a woman, or is that something that you've just...
Yes,
ignored?
It's been flaunted in my face. I mean, I see it every day. So, I mean, I can see when people are getting commissions to do things and getting opportunities, but you just have to keep going to get your own opportunity, and that's, you know, that's the way I've worked with things. I think I'm quite a persistent person and a patient person, and I think I'm a particular character that can be in this world of art, this art world, which is apparently it's one of the most vicious worlds you can be in, even compared to investment banking. My goddaughter said to me, she did both. She's a performer, or could have been. Mm. She spent some time anyway in an office working in the admin management side of music. And she's now an investment banker, and she said it was much harder in music, in the arts world, because there's so little opportunities. So everybody's trying to grab these few opportunities that there are there.
We hear a lot about women being an actress in dancing and musical theatre, but when it comes to composing, do you think that should be opened up? Do you think we should be hearing more about the journey of a composer? Because when you do see women composing, like yourself and many others, it brings a totally different dynamics, isn't it? Earlier you were talking about popular music that you've been brought up to. How have you contributed to, not changing, but just changing perceptions of classical music?
From the inside, it seems, for me, I'm still doing that. I do realise that since entering the field professionally, I mean, when I entered the field professionally, I was the only person I'm aware of, actually. Certainly writing television music as I was.
What do you mean you were the only person?
In specific feel. So in writing music for television...
As a woman.
As a woman.
Right.
I wasn't aware of any.
Right.
And when I worked at Lime Street Studios and recording stuff for television, the sound engineers would say to me, well, you know, you're the only woman we've come across that's doing what you're doing. And I wasn't aware, because at university you're instilled with this idea that you can do everything. And I thought that, of course, there are lots of women doing all this stuff. I wasn't really aware of gender issues. I mean, I had issues of culture to deal with. And so for me, cultural, what a perceived cultural difference is, and stereotyping, that before being female, cultural perceptions were what I had to deal with.
I talk to many people actually about cultural perceptions, and they find that there's a lot of work to fight through before even
getting to
the work that you
are
doing, quite frankly. Just because people are of colour or of ethnic origin, how do we stop that?
I think it's an ingrained thing. Just in the way that my mother ingrained me with, you know, my abilities, and all of us, that we have abilities and opportunities, and we do the best we can with what we've been given, and strive to be the best that you can. I think they're pretty much ingrained. So, you know, it's going right back to the drawing board and saying that all cultures are equal and important.
So Shirley, I obviously know that you were the first woman in 40 years to compose and conduct a symphony.
Yes, well, I completed the symphony in 2003. It was commissioned for the Queen's Golden Jubilee of 2002. So we actually played that part of it to her in that year, in May 2002, when she came to East London, the East London visit. I met her and had a little chat with her and Prince Philip. And
oh, how lovely.
It was lovely.
Absolutely lovely.
So memorable. I've got photos and everything. She's just very curious, and she genuinely wanted to know what was involved and when it would be performed, and she was delighted that I'd written it for her. She just came across as just such a lovely, really lovely lady.
Now, you were named, I think, one of the 14 of the most inspirational women of colour as well. It is important, isn't it, to make sure that women of colour actually are recognised. And is that something that you find that you're always trying to achieve by mentoring and talking to other women who you recognise as being as very, you know, interesting and up-and-coming people?
Well, I mean, of colour doesn't mean to say you're of the same culture. So the distinction is that you could be somebody of colour, but culturally you have the same culture as somebody who's not of colour.
Yeah.
So it's very much, for me, the distinction is about culture. It's not about colour. It's never been about colour to me. It's always about culture. So if you have very strong cultural links to cultures outside of Britain, then that makes the distinction. To me, it's not about colour, it's about culture. It's always about culture. Because you will meet many people of colour and they don't have another culture. I mean, their culture is British.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's ridiculous.
It is. Well said, Shirley. I think that's a really, really good point, actually. Thank you.
Well, it plays into politics, because powers that be will say, oh, we'll get that person of colour. But it doesn't mean to say that they're any different to somebody who's not of colour. So it can be an advantage and a disadvantage. It's a tool that's used, in not always the best way.
Yes. But the tool you have, of course, is your own skills and so much value you bring to the music world, which is composing. As you said, you're a filmmaker as well. You work for the BBC. You do some magnificent stuff. But what project do you think has really taken you with the heart? And I mean, all of them probably have, but is there something that you've pushed the boundaries for? Because I read recently that some of your music, I think is fantastic, actually. Where is it? Where you say you try and come out of the cultural populist classical music, and you are very a fan of R&B music, reggae, soul, contemporary style, which I think is wonderful, because a lot of composers don't actually admit that. And they probably like it.
Right.
And they probably love it. But I think it's great that you want to, and I think from that you're giving younger people the opportunity, aren't you, to bring in. Do you find that you're doing it? I think that's your pioneering moment, actually.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, that's the music I grew up with. That's the vernacular. I mean, I grew up with that music. At the same time as growing up with playing Brahms and Bach and Beethoven, I was, you know, at the discos until 2 o'clock in the morning, dancing my feet off, and that's what I really enjoyed. I mean, I love dancing, and I think dancing and going out, clubbing and stuff, in my earlier days.
When did you become a composer then, from leaving university and moving into the classical world?
Yeah, interesting question. There's no qualification to make you a composer. So I was writing music. I went on to take my lecturer, Prof. Orledge, who's still my mentor, encouraged me to study for an MA in composition. And I did that. I got in at Goldsmiths, and I was delighted to do that. And I wrote a piece for an ensemble that performed early on in my career, just after leaving Goldsmiths, at the Purcell Room. One of my composer colleagues, who was quite a bit older than me, said, oh, that's the work of a great composer. Composer? Me? Composer? Because there's no point that you become a composer as such.
Right.
I mean, now my students come in at 18, they're all composers. I compose this, I compose that. But in my day, you had to be peer reviewed. You had to be acknowledged by peers who were established in the field. And then you sort of get a nod that you were a composer. It was an automatic thing and sort of encouraged into the fold. I would say it was probably after I had my first professional engagements at the Royal Festival Hall and then Greenwich Festival. I was a featured composer, and these all happened in 1985, that I felt, oh, okay, I think I'm a composer. People are calling me composer, because I thought composer was Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, you know, Stravinsky. Of course, they're all men as well. There were no women.
Were you very pleased with that?
Well, the thing is, it's a very kind of nebulous field, because there's no route to it. You make it up as you go along. It all depends on sponsors, who sponsors you. It all depends on your opportunities, the opportunities that are given to you, the opportunities you make for yourself. So people kept saying to me, well, how do you get that? How do you do that? I said, it's all in the back of a brown envelope. You know, there's no route. There's no. It's not like being a chartered accountant when you know yeah. where to go to get your figures right. And there's no route to it at all. So you really have to be, I think you have to have a pretty strong character and forge your own way, and you really need your own individual voice.
The art of writing music, the actual conducting it obviously is another part of it, but writing the music, how do you go about writing your music? Is it like any other piece of music? Do you find that you're sitting down at the table after dinner and thinking, I have a note in my head and I'm going to continue that note? Or do you find that you're on the bus or on the tube? How do you get the inspiration? You've got a lot of music out there.
Yes, all of those things. Sometimes I'm walking along and this phrase is coming into my head, and I develop it in my head as I'm walking to the tube. All of those things. Sometimes in my sleep, sometimes my stomach. What I can't do is sit down and say I'm going to write music now, unless I've already heard it. So I need to have heard it in my head first, and then I can transfer it to some communication in a way that other people can hear it. But I need to hear it in my own head first, and then I can produce it.
Who was your inspiration when you were growing up? You were in a man's world at the beginning, and probably still are a bit as well.
Yeah, very much so. No, I just wasn't aware of it. I mean, I was just doing what I enjoyed doing. It was play to me, and school was play to me. Everything was play to me, and I just enjoyed it. I was a real nerd. So it was all play. I enjoyed writing music. I enjoyed playing music. That's what I enjoyed doing, and I can remember that I was taking my music A-level, and I, out of the blue, I just started writing my own music for my little trio, which was, we had a flute, me on the violin, and...
And you were the violinist,
I was the violinist,
yes.
Flautist, and a pianist. And I just wrote music for the little trio, and that's how it all started. Not trying to be a composer, just saying, oh, well, let's just write some music for this trio. I mean, there was always music in the house, so there was always gospel music in the house, there was always reggae music in the house.
Oh, lovely.
There was always blue beat music, ska. So I grew up in a house full of Jamaican music, My parents are Jamaican, part of my culture is Jamaican. There was always a lot of music in the house, always a lot of dancing. I mean, I remember being taken to parties every week and weddings and christenings. So very, very, I come from a very, very lively culture.
Yeah.
So for me, writing music and performing classical music was very much the thing that Shirley did in the house, because everybody else was, you know, doing other kinds of music. It was just another kind of music to me. It wasn't a special special from what I really liked, which were all the other kinds of music. But somehow, at school, this was the music that you wrote. So that's why I wrote it.
I know you put your heart and soul into everything, but is there one piece that you've thought, I needed to do that?
Yes, there's a piece called The Woman Who Refused to Dance. I was commissioned to write a significant piece for the 250th anniversary of the abolition of the trade in enslaved African people in 2007. With that 500-year legacy, historical legacy and current legacy, because I think we're still living in that post-enslavement period very much in America. There's trauma. I mean, I think we have an enslavement trauma in America, in England, in New Zealand, in Australia, where these enslavements have happened, these colonisations have happened. So I do think the world is living in this kind of traumatised state and not acknowledge, refusing to acknowledge till these criminalities are acknowledged. I think the traumas will continue. I was invited to write this piece and I didn't know what to do. I looked at the whole 500 years of the legacy of the trade, its repercussions, and I went to a meeting at Parliament with the archivists, Parliament, and they showed me this painting of a woman that was created by Isaac Cruikshank. I think it would have been around 1600s, late 17th century. And it was the news of the day, and this woman had been hung by Captain Kimber on his boat because she refused to dance that day. And she was hanging from the sails or something, and she had all the other enslaved people around her, and she also had the sailors around her in this depiction. They were all, the Captain Kim was hovering over her. There were all kinds of implications with all the dynamics of this artwork. And immediately I was absolutely traumatised, and I went home and just wrote the piece, The Woman Who Refused to Dance. It just went gushing out of me.
Wow. It's in there, isn't it? It's in your heart and it stays with you.
Well, what it started was a series that I've continued called Heroines of Opera. So I changed her state of being chastised and being criminalised into one of heroicism. While she's being hung, it's very much her inner voices, you know, this isn't me. I'm actually a princess where I come from, somewhere in Africa. And I'm not going to be demeaned by this inhumane treatment. Mm. So it's actually turns the thing on its head and she becomes a heroine.
And what has been the reaction to these amazing operas? These aren't classic, historic operas. They are historic. It's a historic recount of slavery that is not often told, especially in opera.
That's
so
right.
What has been the reaction to this?
Well, I get people just dumbstruck. I think it's actually sparked a lot of hidden history stories, because since my piece, I've noticed a plethora of similar things. People have realised that, oh, hang on, I can do this similar kind of story. And so it's actually been a springboard for many, many people doing comparable things.
And as you say, opera has never been a medium that has offered this recount of history, and you've started it. So that's been quite an important part for you.
It's an important part, but I'm now struggling to get it into the mainstream, into the main stage. You know.
Right, now
so
that is another area. So that is another challenge for you.
That's my next challenge, yes.
And why do you think there is a big challenge for this? Is that because they don't think it's popular? Who is resisting? And I don't want names, obviously. I really don't want names. That's not what I'm here for.
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
kind of organisations that are resisting it, why are they resisting it?
You need to please ask them for me.
Okay.
Because
I'll try.
When they performed, people just seem to love my work.
Right.
So I know it's not to do with the music, is to do with gatekeepers deciding, well, we'd rather somebody else get this kind of accolade. So I continue pushing on with my stuff.
What other things are you working on that's really taking up, that's very exciting at the moment? Maybe we don't know or we shouldn't know, but yes. What are the things?
Well, in the immediate future, I'm part of a requiem about climate change and the devastations of it. And this is being produced by Chinike Orchestra, who have invited me to do this, and Christian Aid. And this performance is going to be in the St. Paul's Cathedral. It's a very, very big occasion. I'm very much looking forward to it. So I'm actually in the middle of writing that piece.
You as a person are inspiring. If you want to talk to people who are at music school or in school, how would you tell them to be inspired? How would you get them moving and not be frightened by barriers on this present day?
Yes, well, I do this on a daily basis because I teach. And
another little another thing you do, Shirley. Honestly, I haven't read all that list out, have I?
Yes, I teach at university. I teach music students. They really inspire me because they're so full of enthusiasm. They're so clever, very intelligent. They face a lot of challenges. And I say to them, the best thing you can do is to develop your own voice, your own philosophy. That's the thing that's going to take you to the next level. That's the thing that's going to carry you. So then they begin to really take confidence that their voice is what's really important, their own voices. And it is, because that's the thing that will make the difference.
Lots of people are frightened by mistake, failing at something.
With good reason.
With good reason, absolutely. Yeah. So do you try and challenge them to come above that sometimes? Because not only do, I'm talking about women students here, and of course male students too also have that, but from a female point of view, there is always that extra challenge, isn't there?
Oh gosh, yes. Yes, it is a hard thing to face failure, but to me, I mean, I've had a lot of problems with productions where different people haven't been happy with certain things. But I've seen people who equally have risen from the most awful reviews I've seen and awful productions, and they still, it doesn't stop them. I think it's just dusting yourself off and keep going. In my case, I learn from things that haven't gone as well as I would like, and I reflect on, you know, is this to do with your own work, or is it to do with structures? Most often it's to do with structures that you're working with and not actually your own artwork. So you just have to find another way of configuring or working within those structures.
And in today's society, culture, whatever, we're having to face social media as well. So it's a great way of promoting what you do. But it's also, in this day and age, and what has happened very recently, we have to try and curb what we see as well, and the reactions. It's all very well getting reactions in and constructive criticism, but you have to learn, don't you, to take or ignore the really insulting criticism. Everyone's had it.
Yes, it's difficult. It's difficult. You've got those are the gatekeepers, but it's life. Everybody has it. Yeah, you just have to push on, and that's where your self-belief comes in, where you take the bruising and think, well, you know, am I doing something that's worthwhile? And then I'll get a phone call from persons like yourself who say that I'm very influential, and I think, oh, well, am I?
You are.
I've just had this awful, awful, you know, kickback. So, and that's what keeps me going. And then when I have productions on and I see the response of the audience, I mean, the last production was ecstatic.
Yeah, that must absolutely fill you with pleasure.
Oh, it really
it?
Does. It really does. It makes it all worthwhile when you see how well people respond to what I do, you know, outside of the gatekeepers, and you think, oh well, that door there is closed, but look, people are really genuinely interested.
Mm. Your favourite composer?
Ooh.
If there was someone that you aspired to, I mean, even if it was a recent one, I mean, do you meet many other women composers?
Gosh, all the time, yes.
Excellent, that's what I like to hear.
Yeah, I set up with several of my friends, including Judith Weir, Women in Music, back in 1985. So, and I'm still pretty much friends with a lot of those people, Erica Fox, Nicola Nefany. Yeah, I'm still very much friends with...
And you set up Women in Music, is that
with all these other women, because we realised that we were a minority kind of activity. And so we set up Women in Music, and it was... Emotionally, it was a important thing to do. We got together on the South Bank and we talked about our issues and so on. It was very therapeutic to have it. I'm trying to think of, since that, I think we've had a cultural arm where the writers have written about women in music and so on. So it was a very important platform, and now we have several, we have different organisations of women in music. So, but to me, that was the first.
And when you are not composing and when you're not working in this sphere, what do you do? Is there something that sort of turns you completely off and makes you sort of focus on something completely different? Is that something that what do you do?
Oh, gosh, yes. I love films. I love films. And there are some really good television series. I'm actually watching the second Crown at the moment. I resisted it for a long time because I really loved Claire.
The first point, yes.
Oh, I thought she was fantastic. That's fantastic. I loved the first series. So I've just started watching the second. It's good too, but there's something about the first series. So, yeah, I watch a lot of television. In fact, I used to spend a lot of, because I make films, so I actually spent a lot of time in the independent film sector. I've got two films with the British Film Institute, actually.
And tell us about those films.
Those films. They're short films, and one of them is called Memories in Mind, and it's actually about a story of migration. It's about women, and it looks at stories of four women that migrate from the Caribbean, or specifically from Jamaica, to England during the so-called Windrush period. And so you talk about finding work, getting married. One of them's a concert pianist. She talks about her times at one of the conservatoires and the funny little cultural things that used to happen there. So it's a very witty film, because women are very witty. So it's women, it's actually the women themselves telling the stories, and then there are dramatic interludes of a sort of generic woman walking around, knocking on doors, trying to get work. She's crying because she's locked herself out of the house, and all the things that happen to you when you move countries, which fortunately for me, I've never had to do. But
do you feel that when you research it, do you find that you get very upset by what you actually find out that you didn't know before?
Yeah, I think I felt the greatest trauma was probably when I was about 18, 19 and started to read literature by James Baldwin. And so I had the trauma of the experience of other cultures maybe 10 years before. So what I was reading subsequently didn't hit me as much as when I first started reading when I was a teenager. But yeah, they can be upsetting, but it's also exciting because I'm finding material that's not known about. So it's more excitement than anything. So from my point of view, directing films and composing music were one and the same thing, because obviously it was the same process, except I was using different materials slightly, but they were all with the same intention of telling these stories that hadn't been told. I actually started that in film rather than in music. Although, no, my first piece was about knife crime in South London.
Oh, right. Your first piece of music, did you say?
Yeah, it was called Suspected, and it was about sus and men of boys of different cultures being picked up off the street because they were of different cultures.
Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating talking to you. I wish I could have a weekly podcast of you, because your whole enthusiasm, your work is fundamentally wonderful.
And thank you so much.
I really feel that it's been a great pleasure to have you here at Women Making Waves Talk. Thank you so much indeed, Shirley Thompson, OBE. Thank you very much
thank
indeed.
Thank you so much for inviting me here, Susie.
Loved it. When I first researched Shirley J. Thompson, OBE, to really feature on our Women Making Waves, it took me about a year to be able to get her to record with me, because she was a very, and is still, an incredibly very, very busy woman. A composer, she's a filmmaker, she's made music for the Queen. She's done lots of firsts in her life, and I just love what she does. Of course, she devised the music for the Queen's Jubilee as well.
That must have been such an honour to be chosen to do that, actually, out of all of the musicians.
She was saying in the interview that she gets a lot of her inspiration from her mum, because her mum, obviously we've heard this, said that you can be whatever you want to be, but sometimes that's easier said than done. But it didn't really occur to her that that was an easy thing. She just accepted.
That's a recurring theme, though, as well, isn't it? That's what we're hearing from a lot of the women that we interview, that often it is their mothers just saying, you can do whatever you want, you know, just believe in yourself. And the fact the mother believes in them, they, it makes them believe in themselves and makes them just do things because they feel they can. And I think that's quite worth noting, actually. Okay, Susie, I'm really looking forward to hearing one of her pieces. What are we going to be hearing?
Well, it's a piece from her album New Nation Rising, a 21st century symphony. And the actual piece is called Location, Location, Location by Shirley J. Thompson and Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Professor Catherine Barnard is an expert on the legal aspects of Brexit. She is a senior tutor at Trinity College, Cambridge, and apart from having written numerous books, she does a podcast. Catherine talked to Linda about her life.
Catherine Barnard is a legal scholar and professor of European and employment law at Trinity College, Cambridge, where she's the college's senior tutor. Catherine did her master's in law at Fitzwilliam and gained a PhD in philosophy. She is a leading researcher working on the issues surrounding the Brexit negotiations. Catherine was elected a Fellow of Trinity College in 1996, has many published works, does a podcast, and is often called upon by the media to talk about the legal implications of Brexit. Thank you for joining us on Women Making Waves today, Catherine. Now, you were born in Kent and moved to Belfast when you were young. What do you remember about your childhood there?
Being English in that really quite complex environment. I mean, I look back and I remember we spent time, every time we got into the car, we had to check whether there was a bomb placed under the car.
Wow.
We had extraordinary security on the government house that we lived in. We had 9 locks on the front door. And we also had broken glass net curtains in all the windows. So the house we lived in was really spectacularly ugly. But also what I do remember is that Belfast itself, or Northern Ireland itself, was just beautiful. The Giant's Causeway, I still think, is one of the most beautiful places on earth. And anyone who's not been there should really go and visit. The Northern Irish coast is just amazing.
Is it a place that you go back to still these days?
Yes, not as often as I would like. But when I do go back, it's always a revelation because things have improved so much. I took my own children there a couple of years ago to go and see the Titanic Museum, which I must say is one of the best museums I've ever been to. It's absolutely magnificent. As you probably know, the Titanic was built by Harland and Wolff in Belfast. And you really get a sense of what the luxury on the Titanic, but also the extraordinary conditions that the workers had to work in order to actually build the Titanic.
Wow. What did you want to do when you left the school? Was law something that you were always interested in? Or
I think I had a burning sense of injustice as a child, and I always thought law would be a way of resolving that. Of course, the longer you do law, the more you realise that the world is so much more complicated than your 18-year-old self understood. But, I mean, law is, for someone like me, is immensely rewarding. I'm deeply pragmatic, and actually I think quite a lot of English common law is deeply pragmatic. I remember thinking about studying philosophy at university, and when I met the potential teacher who asked me whether I was certain I was there or not, I suddenly realised this is just not for me. Law is much more down to earth and much more engaging. And the fact my own son is now studying philosophy is a good riposte to my own pragmatism.
Now, I was interested to read that you wrote your dissertation on the European litigation strategy of the then Equal Opportunities Commission and how the EU law could be used to deliver greater equality to women. Is that a topic that's close to your heart?
Yes, that's right. And I think this is, for lawyers, that's always been the excitement about EU law, because EU law takes precedence over conflicting national law. And so for lawyers wanting to do social good, EU law presented an extraordinary way of trumping national regulatory regimes. Now, of course, that's the very reason why a lot of people voted Brexit, that they didn't like the fact that there was some out-of-state body, in other words, a court, the European Court of Justice, that was telling the UK what to do. Now, for lawyers who wanted to deliver social change, this was marvellous. But for lawyers and for just members of the public who didn't like the fact that the bodies from outside the UK were telling us what to do, you can see why they were they found the ECJ deeply unappealing.
When you left university, you went on to work in academia. I'm always interested in why people make that choice. Was there never any inclination to join private practice, which is, you know, could be pretty lucrative in the long run as well?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, I can get the best of both worlds. So I really enjoy teaching. I enjoy students. I enjoy watching them actually understand and make some of the connections that, you know, I was making at their age. But also over the years, I've done advisory work for the government and for the EU. I've done some involvement in practice as well. So actually, my life is pretty varied.
Brexit, you mentioned a few minutes ago, and that must have almost taken over your life, I'm imagining. Has it been quite an exciting few years?
It's been exciting. It's been challenging. It's been difficult. Certainly it's taken over my life. I remember when on the day after the referendum, my then very young daughter, I'd promised I'd spend the day with her because I'd been so preoccupied with Brexit in the run-up to the referendum. And I'd promised to spend the day with her because it was a teacher training day. And I couldn't because, of course, there was much interest in the outcome of the referendum. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, "I'm so glad I'm going to get my mummy back now that the referendum is over." But, of course, she was so completely wrong because actually I've probably been busier since the referendum than before.
Yes, yes. That was the start, really, wasn't it, in some respects? Now, you've written articles for The Guardian. You've appeared on Newsnight talking about Brexit. Do you think that people on both sides of the Brexit divide have let emotions win over common sense a lot of the time?
Well, it's interesting. The organisation I've been involved with is called UK in a Changing Europe. And that organisation requires us to be non-partisan when we're talking about Brexit-related issues. And that's been really important, both in the run-up to the referendum and in the period afterwards, right up until the moment when we actually did leave the European Union. And it's therefore required us to be quite measured in what we say and how we say it. And we spend a lot of time thinking about how to explain things in as non-partisan way as possible. Now, it's certainly true that on both sides of the debate, there have been some very vociferous proponents and opponents of what's been going on. But we have been asked and called upon both by broadcasters, but also the government, to try and find a way through to explain what's going on in the most unbiased way possible. And this has been quite a challenge for me as an academic. It's made me think quite long and hard about my subject, but it's also made me think long and hard about how to present things to a non-expert audience as clearly as possible, as simply as possible. I mean, it's also actually introduced me to a very different way of doing social science, because it means I've learned about blogging, I've learned about social media, I've learned about different ways of engaging with the public. And from that point of view, it has been stimulating and interesting and at times absolutely exhausting.
I can imagine. I think you've done that very well, because I know that you've been on the radio with me and you've been explaining Brexit, and it clarified things very nicely. So I think you've managed to do that very, very well.
It's kind of you to say. It may be the years of teaching undergraduates does force you to try and think about how to explain complex ideas in quite a simple language, not necessarily to make the ideas simpler, but I don't think it helps anyone to try and explain complex things in a complex way.
No, when ideas are new, certainly. Now, women working in the legal sector, that's, I think, of interest to you as well, I believe. Having worked in it myself, I can see a marked improvement in the number of women lawyers and partners, certainly since the 70s.
Of course, it has got a lot better, and firms have recognised that in order to carry on employing excellent women, they need to make their work practices better. Now, a lot of firms still don't deliver that very well, and there's still quite a drop-off rate of women in their late 20s, early 30s, which coincides with them having maybe their first child and more often their second child.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly firms are becoming much more willing to allow women to work from home, and paradoxically, it may be that the one very slim silver lining of the coronavirus challenge that we're experiencing at the moment is that so many more of us are going to have to learn how to work from home and work effectively, that actually it will become the new norm. And so actually both men and women will work from home more often.
That's really interesting that you say that, because we were talking about that at work today, exactly the same. I think this is going to cause a massive shift in the way that things are done, actually.
I think that's right. And even in wearing my university hat, we've long taught in a very standard way, small group teaching, groups of two or three plus big lectures. But I think given that so much more is going to have to be delivered online over the next couple of months, I think people are going to have to learn very fast what technology is out there and how it can be used most effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I think it will change things. Now, Professor Dame Sally Davies is the first woman master of Trinity College. Do you feel that having women in senior positions in academia has changed the way that things are done?
I think so. I think it's more complicated than just saying having a woman master is good, having a male master is bad. Because I think there is a generational shift, and certainly I've been in academia a long time now, and some of my greatest supporters have been men. So I think it's a more complex than that, just simple binary, men are bad, women are good, quite the contrary. But I think actually having Sally Davies, who, as you know, is the ex-chief medical officer, in such a prominent position, with her years of experience in the public sector, and actually bringing some fresh insight from outside, has been really very good indeed for the college.
Yes, it must be quite interesting working with her at the moment, actually, with the coronavirus. She must have opinions on that, presumably.
She does. I mean, obviously, she's very supportive of her successor, but she obviously was the woman who had written a lot of the contingency plans and signed them off last year. Mm-hmm. So she has a deeper knowledge about what may or may not happen than the rest of us.
Now, you've written how many? 12 books, I think?
Oh, too many. Plenty to cure those with insomnia.
Where do you find the time?
Middle of the night.
Really?
Yes, true.
you do. Are you one of these people that stays up really, really late?
Yeah, or I get up very early. But whatever, either way, it's fitted in amongst all sorts of other things.
And what are your hobbies when you have time?
Hobbies is something I struggle with a bit. But I've got three kids, and I take huge, huge pleasure and being with them. They're all very keen footballers, so I spend a lot of Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings standing on cold touch lines watching the local football team.
That I don't envy you. Catherine Barnard, thank you very, very much for joining us today on Women Making Waves. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
I really enjoyed talking to Catherine. I've actually met her two or three times before, because she's been in doing radio shows with me talking about Brexit. I always find her really, really interesting. What I love about her is that she's very measured when she's talking about, you know, quite emotive things like Brexit. It's her area of expertise.
Mm.
I thought what was really interesting was she was on the panel on Newsnight, and she was actually applauded for being the most sensible person in the room by lots of people on Twitter, which made me smile, because she did sound like she was.
But that's interesting, applauded for being probably honest as well. And that's what people are looking for, isn't it?
Well, she was actually giving the facts.
Yeah.
And because she's, well, I'm not saying she's not one side or the other, I don't know, but her view is very down the middle because she's just dealing with facts, not emotions. I liked talking to her about Brexit for that very reason, because, you know, unemotional about it.
And her past, her growing up in Northern Ireland, is this equally as fascinating, and also total respect for her as well, but what she had been going through.
Yeah, I think because of the work that her father did, you know, it was probably quite a dangerous place to be. But she really loves Ireland. You know, she's saying she goes back when she can. She finds it a very beautiful place. I've never been to Northern Ireland, actually. Have you, Susie? I've been to Southern Ireland, but not Northern Ireland.
No, I've only been to Southern Ireland. I'd love to go to Northern Ireland. It's something that I'd like to do. But I'm always in awe of people that have grown up in a sort of a trauma place, but seen the beauty of a place as well. And I find that wonderful to be able to recognise and do at the same time, because what Northern Ireland went through in those days is phenomenal.
Oh, it must have been incredibly difficult. But I think as a child, you probably focus on other things. You know, you've got your schoolwork and your friends to focus on, and everything else just becomes part of everyday life. A little bit like this COVID-19 thing. You know, I think the kids will probably adapt to it quite quickly, because they adapt to things very, very readily. And I can imagine she's a very good tutor. I would, if I were doing law, I would certainly like to be tutored by Catherine. She's great. That's all we've time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Professor Catherine Barnard and Shirley Thompson, OBE. If you know of a woman who's making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW, or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also catch up with our programme on cambridge105.co.uk, and you can visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.